The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. It's not every week that we can report on books that have made newspaper headlines, but this week is an exception. On the very same day, Smiths frontman Morrissey released a novel, sending generations of fans into a frenzy of anticipation, and a woman won the Royal Society Science Book of the Year for the first time in the prize's 28-year history. 2 days earlier, the long list for the UK's leading non-fiction prize was revealed, featuring another science writer, Oliver Morton, who joins us later. But first, let's turn to the one and only Morrissey and the journalist who sat up through the night to review List of the Lost for The Guardian, Michael Hann. Michael, was it worth it?
It's the worst book I've ever read, Claire, by a distance. Was it worth it? It was an exercise in self-flagellation. I seem to become the Guardian's overnight Morrissey correspondent because I did the same with his autobiography as well, which is a much, much better book.
But the autobiography was widely criticised as well, wasn't it? Not least because he demanded that it was published as a Penguin classic.
Morrissey's hubris knows no bounds, but autobiography had the advantage of, first, having something to say, because Morrissey's life is interesting. Second, having some charm, at least in the first half, where he's talking about his youth and about his love of music before he descends into the rancour against all the many people who've crossed him. And also, being reasonably well written. And the new book, the novel, List of the Lost, is the worst written book that has ever crossed my path. I'm just astonished that Penguin published it. I mean, Penguin should be ashamed of themselves. I mean, it is disgusting that they let that book come out.
Can you praise this great work of literature for us?
It's almost impossible to do that. But in short, four young athletes, a relay team at a college in Boston, find themselves confronting a homeless man who tries to grope one of them. The homeless man gets killed, and after that, a succession of dreadful events are unleashed upon our heroes.
You wrote your initial piece as a list of things that we learned about Morrissey. Should we just go through them? You've sort of already touched on the first one, which is that Morrissey's ego remains untrammelled. You said that this might have been okay as a 20-page short story.
It might have been okay as a 20-page short story if an editor had been let near it. It doesn't seem to me that an editor was allowed anywhere near it. They probably weren't near autobiography as well, but at least there's a structure to that that enabled Morrissey to actually get his story out. With this, he needed someone to tell him how to write a story, because he cannot tell a story. It's just incomprehensible. The novel tries to have peaks and troughs. You know, there are dramatic events in there. In fact, for a novella of that brevity, there are a remarkable number of dramatic events, but he has no facility for signalling them within prose. He just thinks that once he's put it down, that is there. It is marvellous. I have done it.
Your second point, Morrissey is still hugely hung up about sex.
Yeah, the attitudes to sex are very odd throughout. There's a widely quoted and excruciating descriptive passage of sex, but that's not the worst of it. Sex is tied up with death, and not in the sense of, you know, le petit mort. It's not the moment of death after the act. It's literally when sex happens, someone gets killed. You know, there's predatory paedophilia that results in people being killed. It's just death permeates everything. This is a man who is deeply afraid of sex. I mean, one might say he's deeply afraid of women as well. I mean, the review in the Daily Beast picked up on misogyny. I kind of thought that. I mean, his attitudes to women are very, very odd. But in fact, he hates everyone except lissome young men. It's not so much misogyny as general misanthropy.
Will you just read us that widely quoted sex passage?
It is remarkable. Eliza and Ezra rolled together into the one giggling snowball of full-figured copulation, screaming and shouting as they playfully bit and pulled at each other in a dangerous and clamorous rollercoaster coil of sexually violent rotation, with Eliza's breasts barrel-rolled across Ezra's howling mouth and the pain frenzy of his bulbous salutation extenuating his excitement as it smacked its way into every muscle of Eliza's body, except for the otherwise central zone. It's not very erotic, is it, really? You're not going to crack one off to that, let's be honest.
The pain frenzy is ours, one might say.
But bulbous salutation is just the single greatest phrase ever, because it can be used for everything. I'm now greeting people in the morning with bulbous salutations to you. My colleague on the music desk, Alexis Petridis, made the point that it sounds very much like something Mr. Timothy Claypole from the 70s children's show Rent-A-Ghost would say. Bulbous salutations!
Your third point. Morrissey can't write dialogue.
No, the dialogue... Now, some people have had a go at me saying, it's fiction, it's not meant to be realistic. No, I know it's not meant to be realistic, but all the dialogue sounds like Morrissey at his most arch and self-indulgent. Now, if you're going to set a book in Boston in 1975, then make a little bit of effort. The athletics coach, Mr. Rims, which one suspects is a name chosen carefully, makes some concessions to being American by periodically saying use in amongst all his highfalutin, incredibly convoluted expounding. But all the characters speak exactly the same. You can't differentiate between them at all because of the peculiar way in which they speak. I was talking about someone else, an American, about this, and we were saying, wouldn't it be amazing if they actually made a film of this with Boston actors? So playing the four central relay characters, you'd have Matt Damon, Mark Wahlberg, Ben Affleck, and Seth MacFarlane, and have them deliver the Morrissey dialogue in Boston accent. It would be marvellous.
So points 4, 5, 6, and 7 are Morrissey has scores to settle part 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Yep.
Tell us about some of these scores.
Well, Morrissey, of course, is famous for his dim view of the judiciary. After he fought a court case in which the Smith Rhythm Section, Mike Joyce and Andy Rourke, were demanding a greater share of the revenues from the Smith catalogue. Morrissey lost the case and was branded devious, truculent, and unreliable by the judge. And since then, he's taken every opportunity to take a pop at judges. I mean, this is a song lyric, I bear more grudges than lonely high court judges. This is where the autobiography goes off the rails. It descends into a long tirade against the judiciary and the judge who found against him in particular. Now, pretty well every single character in List of the Lost has something to say about judges. Every one of them, even the homeless man who gets killed, who is ostensibly the demon that unleashes the dreadful events upon our quartet, even he finds time to go into a tirade against how awful judges are and how they don't understand real people and how awful what they do is. Characters are always explained that there is a difference between justice and the law, because the law is what did Morrissey wrong. He got no justice. And you just want to say, leave it, mate. Just leave it.
School system did him wrong as well.
School system did him wrong. One of the best Smith songs is The Headmaster Ritual, which opens belligerent ghouls run Manchester schools, spineless swine, cemented minds. And those belligerent ghouls are running the college in Boston at which our heroes are studying. The evil principal is a paedophilic murderer. Of course he is. I mean, Morrissey cannot see an authority figure without wanting them to be a paedophilic murderer.
And he is a vegetarian.
Morrissey famously a vegetarian. The Smiths, well, their second album was entitled Meat is Murder. And Morrissey feels this strongly. We know this. He gets venues not to serve meat from their food concession stalls when he plays there. He has long criticised any culture in which meat-eating is a regular part. He said some unfortunate and really, frankly, racist-sounding things about countries that eat particular kinds of meat that he feels especially strongly about. The Chinese have felt the brunt of his criticism. But he goes into a long digression about the evils of meat-eating in this, and particularly about how awful carnivores are with their Big Mac podge children. It's just, well... Write an essay about it. It has no place in your novel.
So, you probably won't be sitting up all night to read List of the Lost, but if you do, it's published by Penguin. As I said at the start of this podcast, it's not only Morrissey who's been in the news this week. Here's Gaia Vince at the Royal Society Winton Prize in London.
I'm absolutely gobsmacked. I'm so shocked. I was shocked to be shortlisted. I'm absolutely shocked to have won. Yeah, it's amazing. I'm so happy.
Why did you write this book? You left a perfectly good day job to go and travel the world.
I know, it's crazy from a career perspective. It's crazy from a financial perspective, but it was a burning desire because I was sitting in a desk, because I was stuck in this office in King's Cross, right next to the Guardian headquarters, actually. And I was sending reporters out to bring back these incredible stories. And I was coming across all these papers and they were telling me the biology, the chemistry, the physics, the life on this planet has completely changed. Rivers are being dammed. Oceans are changing their acidity. We're running out of fish. The atmosphere is changing. And there was one common thing through all of this. It was humans. It was us. We were changing all this. And I thought, God, what am I doing sitting at this desk? I really have to go out there. I really have to find the people at the forefront of all these changes and find out what on earth's going on there. You know, what do we have in store for us and how are they reacting to it? Yeah.
One of the things as judges, and I was a judge, that we remarked on was how actually optimistic it was. And so you have amazing anecdotes of people who are living in these really inhospitable environments. At the ceremony just earlier, you read a little bit about some people who are painting a mountain white in order to recreate glaciers. I was very moved by the cloud capture story. Tell us a little bit about the particular stories.
Isn't it remarkable that people will be pushed to such an extent that they consider painting a mountain? And it totally is like some sort of Herculean task. You can't imagine anyone would do that. And yet there are these incredible people who, when push comes to shove, instead of running away, instead of panicking, they come up with solutions and they come up with these amazing solutions. So yes, there were two guys painting a mountain white. Incredible. There were these other people who were trying to create a forest on a desert in a slum. I mean, it shows really. And what I tried to say with this book is that we are incredible. We are this ingenious, remarkable species. And yeah, we have brought some problems on ourselves, but look what we have done. We've doubled our lifespans. We live so comfortably. We can solve so many of our problems that would have killed people in the past. We are really remarkable. And when push comes to shove, we come up with solutions. We come up with these amazing ideas. And it is a hopeful book. I am a hopeful, optimistic person. And who can't be? You know, if you have small children, as I do, you can only be hopeful. Otherwise, you're essentially resigning their lives to misery. And you know, who would do that?
So that you've mentioned your small children. You went with your husband. Your husband took the photographs. The photographs in this book are beautiful. So this is a sort of family crusade. Did you drag him on it?
Basically, yeah. I mean, so this was before my partner and I, we had children. So we went traveling. He took the photographs. He takes photos. These amazing, beautiful pictures. The ones chosen for the book aren't even the most beautiful pictures that he takes. But what we're trying to do is really show people how incredible our planet is, how diverse it is. And from a human perspective, I mean, the planet is amazing. Animals are amazing. Landscapes are amazing. But to me, they're most amazing when they interact with people, when we put our stamp on it, or to look through our lens. That's where the real beauty of this planet comes in.
Guy Vince there. Adventures in the Anthropocene is published by Chatto & Windus.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
It just so happens that our studio guest covers the same issues in his latest book, which has just been longlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction. He's Oliver Morton, and he came in to talk to Richard Lee about The Planet Remade, how geoengineering could change the world.
The concert. It is not a large nation that does it. Indeed, it is not a single nation's action at all. There is a small group of them, two of which are in a position to host the runways. They call themselves the concert. Once they go public, others call them the affront. None of them is a rich nation, but nor are they among the least developed. All of them already have low carbon dioxide emissions, and all of them are on pathways to no emissions at all. Not too hard for small developing nations with sun, sea breezes, and no aptitude for or ambition towards heavy industry, but still impressive. In climate terms, they look like the good guys. But their low emissions and the esteem of the environmentally conscious part of the international community are doing nothing to reduce the climate-related risks their citizens face. Indeed, the fact that their commitment to mitigation does nothing to make their people safer is a point to which they return on numerous occasions in the years following the group's establishment. The hardware is mostly sourced from the Brazilian and Indonesian aerospace industries. The only bits of the plane's design that are really new are the wings and the spraying kit. The engines and the fuselage are adapted from other craft. The tanker planes that extend their lifting capacity and their range are utterly standard. The aircraft's development had been overseen and paid for by one of the world's increasingly numerous billionaires who had made her money from high-density data storage systems. Her cover story was the development of a space tourism follow-on to Virgin Galactic. The project's name was Espadaire, a name that stuck, even when the cover was blown. The project cost more than the most extravagant of her peers had ever spent on a yacht, but not all that much more. The Consort has two sites for operations, one in Central America, one in the South Pacific. With a few flights a day from each site, they deliver a few tens of thousands of tons of aerosol to the stratosphere over the first year. Sprayed out comfortably above the tropical and subtropical tropopause in both hemispheres, this forms a tolerably even, remarkably tenuous veil. There had at one time been a satellite devoted to measuring stratospheric aerosol density, which might have allowed researchers to notice the veil's creation, but after the satellite's life was over, no one replaced it. There's always some group with an even more interesting set of measurements to make, and there are only so many missions you can launch. After 18 months of operations, the Consort announces what it has been up to at the UNFCCC Climate Summit of 2020-something. The Consort presents its program as an act of civil disobedience. Not the countries say that they are actually breaking international laws. If their actions were hostile, they would have been in breach of the UN's NMOD convention. If they caused demonstrable harm, they might be liable under customary international law. Neither is the case, says the Consort. But the countries making the veil are happy to admit that they are breaking the norms of international relations in a way that might inconvenience, discomfort, even shock. Civil disobedience does that. When there is a just cause to be fought for, the Consort argues, and when there is no forum in which the fight for that cause shows any sign of making progress, then something like civil disobedience is called for. To disobey the tenor of times, they say, is not a crime. It is a duty. The practical aim of its action, the Consort explains, is straightforward and limited. It does not intend to stop or reverse global warming. It intends only to slow it. It plans to thicken the veil at a pace that its climate modellers think will keep the rate of warming at or below 0.1 degrees centigrade a decade. A limit to the rate of change of the temperature, the historically minded are reminded, had been a widely canvassed objective when action on greenhouse gases was first mooted in the 1980s. The Consort's target, if it could deliver it, would mean that over the rest of the century the temperature would rise about as much as it did over the 20th century. Cumulative change by the end of the century would remain below the 2 degree centigrade limit. How thick the veil might have to be to achieve this would depend on future emissions. Even if they went unchecked, the veil would not reach the thickness seen after a large volcanic eruption for almost a century. But the Consort makes it clear that it doesn't want emissions to go unchecked. It wants other nations to commit, as its members have, to quite steep cuts in emissions. And it is happy to welcome to its ranks nations that make such commitments, especially if they also commit to the development and deployment, over time, of technologies for carbon dioxide removal. As new members of the Consort, those acceding nations get a say in decisions about revisions to the veil-making plan in view of new monitoring data and new understanding of the Earth system. The original Consort members are aware that they started with inadequate monitoring and sketchy knowledge and are keen to reduce the risks that brought with it, as well as revisions that might be required by new trends in the politics of emission. Other nations get no such say.
So, given that climate change risks grave dangers to the planet and cutting carbon emissions is hard, what should we be doing about it?
Well, we should be trying to cut carbon emissions, but we should also be thinking about what other things are possible, what other things we see affecting the climate around us. And we should be bearing in mind that this isn't a simple problem of just getting rid of a pollutant that's easily replaceable, it's not easy to imagine how an industrial civilization does entirely without carbon dioxide emissions. It's not easy to imagine how a capitalist industrial civilization makes that transition. And it's certainly not easy to imagine how it does so very quickly. So given those failures or those barriers to imagination, I began to ask why people weren't more open to imagining that you might do something about the problem through more technical means, not as a straightforward technological fix, but as another part of the armamentarium that you bring to the problem, as another bit of the toolkit. And there are two options that people talk about in this area, and you can call them carbon methods and sunshine methods. You could also see them as input methods and output methods. The sunshine methods try to deal with just having less sunshine coming into the system. Global warming is, of course, driven by sunshine. If there's a little bit less sunshine coming in, then you will get a little bit less warming. So that you can imagine doing simply by making the Earth a little bit brighter. And there are various ways to make it reflect a bit more sunlight. And the easiest way to think of doing that on a global scale is by putting tiny reflecting glittery particles into the upper atmosphere. So that's, I suppose, the prototypical sunshine method. There are various other ways to make the Earth more glittery that have been discussed over the decades. The other option is to look at technologies for taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And in some ways, that's much more emotionally appealing because, for one thing, it doesn't involve putting something into the system, which always sounds like, you know, fighting pollution with more pollution. And at the same time, it feels restorative. It feels like you're cleaning up after yourself. And those are good feelings, and there's a good reason why those are good feelings. The problem is that we put carbon dioxide, humans put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at a really startling rate. And certainly until you've stopped putting it in, taking it out looks a bit foolish. Even if you've stopped putting it in, taking it out, you're going to have to do an extraordinarily large scale to have much of an effect.
And that's just because there's not much of it in there, even though it's having a big effect.
That's one of the things, yes. I mean, carbon dioxide, although it's a very, although there's much more of it in the atmosphere than there used to be, 400 parts per million is not very much. If you took
a millionaire, you have to get through a lot of air get the carbon.
If you take a millionaire and say, I'll just give you 400 quid for all that, then he will say, no, that's not a good deal. So taking it out is difficult because it's dilute. It's also difficult because there's just a lot of it. I mean, you basically would be putting the carbon extractive industries of the Earth, which, as we know, are big, powerful industries, into reverse in order to take out as much carbon dioxide as they're putting in. So I think that there is a real future for some sorts of carbon dioxide reduction, but they don't operate on a fast time scale, whereas these ideas of brightening the planet, especially by brightening the atmosphere, those could operate on a fast scale, which is both something that's promising about them and something that's scary about
them. And you imagine a way in which this kind of project could start in your book as well, but it's the idea is a kind of veil of sulfates, of particles up high that throw a bit of the sunlight off before it heats us up.
Well, the example that people know about from this is that this is what happens after volcanoes. Volcanoes throw ash and grit and dirt into the atmosphere, and they also throw up sulfurous gases, which once they reach the stratosphere turn into these tiny little particles, which scientifically people call aerosol particles. And a very thin veil of aerosol particles can act to cool the planet below it. It's like a very, very thin sunscreen. Now, what you get with a volcano is that you throw up tens of millions of tons of this stuff, if it's a big volcano, all at once, in about a day or so, and then it takes years to come back down. During the years after a large volcanic eruption, measurements on the surface show fairly clearly that the Earth cools down a bit. You saw this after the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in the 1990s. It happened after Krakatoa. It happened after Tambora, the very large eruption in the early 19th century. But what happens there is you're throwing up a huge amount of the stuff and then it all comes back down. What you'd imagine doing if you were to use something similar for geoengineering is that you would put up a very small amount of the stuff, but you'd keep it topped up so that the rate at which it went in was, roughly speaking, the rate at which it was falling out.
But there are worries about this kind of strategy, particularly because it's an experiment that's kind of been run before. I mean, with catastrophic effects as well. There's a strong link between sulfates put into the atmosphere as an industrial byproduct and droughts in the Sahel during the 70s and 80s.
That's very true, and that's an interesting point. And the link is clear between the Sahel droughts and the surface temperatures in the sea in that time, and it's fairly indicative that there was something to do with industrial pollutants. That said, there's fairly good evidence from modelling which suggests that this is because you had an asymmetric effect there. You had a strong cooling effect over the north and tropical Atlantic. What you'd be talking about with something like this would be a much gentler cooling effect and all over the world. But you're quite right. For instance, volcanic eruptions in the northern hemisphere cause droughts in the Sahel, just as it appears that industrialization in Europe and America may have done so in the 1960s.
But the ways in which the Earth is, the climate and the weather all over the planet is linked, poorly understood. And
that's absolutely true. But this is also one of the reasons why we should, and I emphasize always, we should be very worried about global warming and climate change. We do not fully understand how this system works. We don't, in fact, in some ways, understand how it works at high carbon dioxide levels any better with or without geoengineering. It's very, very difficult to know what's going to happen. So you have to have an extremely responsive system. You also have to have a very vibrant public debate and a system that is in hands in which you have some sense of trust.
So at the beginning of the 20th century, science and technology was promising unlimited energy, it was liberation from drudgery. Why should we have this kind of trust in a scientific, a technological solution to this problem caused, indeed, by industry and science?
Well, that's an interesting issue. In that, I mean, for about 2 billion people, science and technology has provided a quasi-unlimited energy, energy resources at a level that are unlike what anyone else had seen in all human history. And so, you know, there are now about 1 billion people in the developed world and about 1 billion people of the 6 billion people in the developing world who live lives that are really almost unimaginable in the early 20th century, and that's been done through fossil fuels. There's a huge developmental challenge to try and do something similar for all the other people on the planet, not to provide them with energy in the same ways, but also not to say, well, that's the chips are played now, that's it, no more, everyone else stays without the energy. That's not either feasible or remotely just. So you have a development process going on that you need to encourage, you need to rebalance, you need to make it as clean as you can. But that still makes one of the, I think, reasons that it's very hard to imagine just shutting off carbon dioxide emission. So science and technology made some promises and kind of delivered on some of them. But the problem, I think, always the problem with this, is the sort of thinking that, oh, we've done that, that's solved, on to the next thing. The point is that there's, especially when you start intervening in the planet, there's just a huge amount of aftercare. And that's just as much true, it's probably more true if you try and do something deliberately than if things just get left to happen, which is what we've seen so far.
Okay, so it reminds me a little bit of medical interventions, in that when you get somebody who's got some serious illness and they get into hospital, then the doctors try something and it tends to make them sicker. Is that where we are with the planet?
Well, by and large, hospitals don't tend to make people sicker. I mean, if they really did do that on a routine basis. Yes, there are risks, and that's why it's very important that this be discussed broadly and in as wide a political context as possible. But there are huge risks to inaction, and I think that there's something strange I sometimes find about a discourse around climate change which says it's absolutely terrible. Oh, and that's it. So if it's really absolutely terrible, then you really ought to be looking at things that may be unsavory to you that might be alternatives. And that means that some people should be looking at things like making changes to their lives that they wouldn't otherwise want to make. But mandated large-scale lifestyle choice is a very hard thing to imagine pulling off. And it's a somewhat hard thing to imagine really getting behind morally. And so I think you need to look at other ways of attacking it, not least because simply broadening up the space of solutions you look at, I think, is in itself a healthy thing to do. I think there's a way in which carbon dioxide, in which climate change became seen entirely as a matter of industrial carbon dioxide emissions, when there's an awful lot else going on to do with land use change and the legitimate desire of people to enrich themselves, that all became sort of like boiled down to the amount of this molecule that was in the atmosphere. And we need to have a broader conversation. And I think that talking about deliberate technological interventions could, this is possibly somewhat utopian of me, but what the hell, why not? It could help broaden out the discourse in a way that would be very helpful, even if one in the end decides, no, we don't want to do any of this stuff, which I think is still an entirely possible, plausible, and possibly desirable outcome.
But what about the dangers of actually even discussing, even doing research into this, with the idea that if we can move the focus away from having to control carbon dioxide, which we all admit is very, very hard, then we're going to lose the impetus to do so?
This is the argument that this is probably the strongest argument against these discussions, that if you say, oh, well, if things get really bad, we'll do some geoengineering, then you remove the urgency of carbon dioxide reduction. To which I suppose the most obvious answer is, what urgency? It's not as though the world is actually, I mean, yes, there's some improvement in the carbon dioxide situation in some places, but it's not as though carbon dioxide emissions are not still climbing really quite impressively. And so if there was a really, really strong effort that people were really buckling under the strain and you suddenly offered them this alternative and they said, okay, we'll give up on this, that would be one thing. But that's not the world we're living in. But it also means that I always try and stress, and I have very little time for people who don't make this distinction, that geoengineering must be part of a portfolio of responses, if you want to use it at all. The idea that it just replaces all other responses gets you right back to zero, and that's a terrible solution. I think that the belief that left to themselves, people will choose the terrible solution has an appealing cynicism, but I actually don't think it's a foregone conclusion.
And nevertheless, the idea that people are denying that this is a problem at all to be addressed gives you somewhat the fear that they might leap to an easy solution if an easy solution is offered.
There is that fear, but that leap to an easy solution is not going to be made any easier by the fact that people are out there discussing it. But I mean, the broader and more engaged the discussion is on this topic, the harder it will be for people to demagogue it and say, okay, let's just send up the planes right now and we'll sort it all out. The best defense, I think, against that sort of sudden flip-flop in ideas, as you know, it's a fear that a lot of people have who talk about geoengineering, that the American right will go from denying that there's a climate change problem to saying it's an entirely solvable problem. The best way to stop that from happening is to have a broad discussion of this sort of technology already going on, rather than to say, oh, we don't want to talk about that at all. That's the way to suddenly get surprised by this.
It's part of the problem with climate change, a failure of imagination, a failure that makes it easy to imagine an apocalypse, but impossible to construct a believable utopia.
I think a huge amount of our... You mentioned in the early 20th century, there was an idea of a utopian free energy coming from the nucleus, coming from atomic power. This is the idea that you get in Frederick Soddy and in H.G. Wells. Of course, in the middle of the century, we get a very different imaginary from nuclear power. And it becomes very easy to imagine the end of the world in a way that's really... There was, of course, always discourses about the end of the world, but the idea that the world could end in a real practical tomorrow sort of way, I think maybe we don't appreciate quite how profoundly that affects the 20th century imagination and how profoundly it affects our imagination of ways that the world goes wrong. That we have this very catastrophic imagination of the future in which we cannot but imagine the end of the world and sometimes get a sneaky slight pleasure from it. There's a line from the literary theorist Frederick Jameson that it is easier to imagine the end of capitalism than the end of the world, and that says a lot about how deeply rooted capitalism is in our imagination. It also says a lot about how easy it has become to imagine the end of the world. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I could go and see 5 movies before next Friday in which the world ends, or in which people scavenge on after the world's end. It's become an absolute set piece of our imagination. Imagining ways in which the world doesn't end and yet is changed, that seems to me striking and different and potentially transformative.
So what kind of world do we need to imagine if we're going to get people inspired with a positive vision?
we need to imagine a world in which the fact that humans are a dominant force in the way that world works does not mean that that world is an entirely human world. We have to see a world in which we don't refuse to use the extraordinary instrumental power of human science technology, but in which we have a restraint and an aesthetics and a politics about the use of that power that allows us to actually make beautiful things. I think if you can't imagine this world being beautiful, and if you can't actually imagine not merely a restored beauty, but a, to some extent, transformed or enhanced beauty, I don't think you're doing it right. And you also have to think about a world that is, in some fundamental way, more just. It's a very difficult thing. I'm still, I said about it being difficult to be utopian. It is very difficult to be utopian. I'm still struggling towards it myself. But I think something about responsibility, justice, and beauty, and about this idea of both using and knowing when not to use the power, rather than being afraid to use it under any circumstances, that would be where I'd start.
So, and your idea of a veil in the atmosphere is born out of despair that nothing is happening, and there's a bridging loan into that possible future.
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I don't want to make very binding choices on the future. I think the idea that this is only ever a stopgap, I think that there may be choices that future generations make that I can't begin to imagine, just as I don't really think that people in the 18th and 17th century had much of an imagination about now. This is one of the things that's really difficult about climate change, is it's not about next week, it's not about next year, it's not about next decade. These are huge processes, and anything that purports to be a solution to them is also a huge and long drawn out process. And adding these deliberate interventions to the changes in the economic and technical way that we organize our energy systems, that seems to me to bring you forward towards this idea of working on a century timescale, even a millennial timescale, rather than only the timescale of the next day and the next event.
Oliver Morton there, talking to Richard Lee. The Planet Remade is published by Granta. Thanks to him, to Michael Hahn, and congratulations to Gaia Vince. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Eva Krishak, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.